completed a PA in economics and social policy and admin at the University of Kent in the late 80s, and then decided to be a psychologist. Went on to complete an MSc in experimental psychology at the University of Sussex, an MSc in psychological research methods at the University of Exeter, and finally a PhD in the psychology of self-perceived intuitiveness at the University of Hertfordshire. That was Richard Wiseman as your supervisor. He's worked at the University of Central Lancashire since 2002, first as a lecturer, and since 2007 as a senior lecturer in psychology. His research interests include the psychology of belief in the paranormal, the Barnum effect, self-perceived intuitiveness, psychological factors underlying lottery play, and child sexual abuse blame attributions. So I personally like to hear talks on all of those, but tonight Paul's going to be talking to us about paranormal belief and the misperception of coincidental events. Thanks very much, Chris.
For all the members of the audience, just apologies, I will not be singing any Queen songs after this. Okay? So. No, no, it's a bad joke. Right, so. Misperceptions of coincidences. I'm going to start with an anecdote, which any psychologist knows is not really worth the paper it's printed on. But it's a nice way of introducing what we mean by remarkable coincidence experiences. This is not London Bridge, but it's meant to be London Bridge. It's, what, roughly, what, 1991? I'm standing on London Bridge. I think it's a Wednesday evening, about 9 o'clock. That's me. I'm just minding my own business, you know, waiting for my train, and I see in the distance one of these baggage trolleys, you know, the sort of things that motorise, that reporters drive along. This baggage trolley had one driver, it was two carts, there was no luggage on there, and there was no members of the public anywhere near. And I'm absent-mindedly sort of thinking, I wonder how often they roll over into the railway lines. And guess what happened? Within the space of about 15 feet, this baggage trolley rolled straight into the railway lines. Luckily no one was hurt, but it gets you thinking. I had a little prediction. Now, some people would say that was a case of precognition, sort of paranormal awareness of future events. Or you could say it was a telepathic awareness of what the driver was thinking. He's thinking, I'm going to drive into the railway lines, it'll be fun. Or it could be some sort of clairvoyant, although I could actually see him, so it's less likely. But it could have been paranormal. Many people would have said it would be paranormal. Me being sceptical says, well, it's just a coincidence. But this is the sort of thing we're looking at. We're looking at why people believe these coincidence events might be paranormal. So what I'm hoping to do today is give a little bit of background about the cognitive deficits model. The idea is that paranormal believers are somehow deficient in cognitive processing. And I'll go through some more details about that. But there's a general belief that paranormal believers are more prone to misunderstanding probability and randomness. And I'll introduce this thing called the conjunction fallacy. I won't say too much about that now. I don't want to spoil the surprise. And then I'm going to overview three studies that I've, two of which I've recently published, the first two, and the last one that's still being worked on the train as we came down. Okay? So I'll be looking at BIP is belief in the paranormal. So I'll be looking at the relationship between belief in the paranormal, event type, that would be paranormal or normal events, and question format, the way we ask certain questions, the way they're presented. In the second study, looking at the relationship between two events and how that impacts on perceptions of coincidence, and the notion of potential surprise, how surprising one event might appear to be compared to another one. And in the last study, we're looking at factors like the size of an event or how vividly it's described, and does that influence people's perceptions of paranormal phenomena. Okay, that's what I hope to do. But I know Chorter are playing tonight, so I might want to dash out halfway through. No, anyway, so paranormal belief. This is admittedly a newspaper survey from about 13 years ago now, 1,000 respondents. But what you can see here is how prevalent paranormal belief is. Presumably some people here from psychology have witnessed Chris's lectures on this, so you might know this stuff anyway. But what we can see here is that roughly two-thirds of this particular sample believe in powers that science can't explain, the implication being as some sort of paranormal phenomenon. If you look more closely at some of the more specific ones that I'm interested in here, precognitive dreams, roughly 40% of people believe in those, and roughly 20% have experienced them, allegedly. Thought reading or telepathy, just under half believe, and about a sixth have experienced. And down here, fortune telling, which you can include, you know, sort of psychic reading and clairvoyancy, roughly a third believe in, and that, again, about a sixth have experienced. So paranormal belief is quite prevalent, and many people have claimed to experience these things. Okay. Now, generally speaking, the psychology of paranormal belief can be broken down into four subcategories. Am I going too quick before I go any further? Should I slow?
No.
No? Should I go quicker?
No.
Okay. The first model is a social marginality hypothesis, which simply says that people on the edge of society, whatever you might define that as, people who feel deprived and alienated from society are more likely to believe in the paranormal. Now, this is a sort of sociological model from the 70s, and there's not really much solid evidence for that. The worldview hypothesis looks at the relationship between paranormal belief and other wider esoteric viewpoints, such as religiosity or people's recall of dreams. And there's some evidence there's a link between certain personality characteristics. Doesn't really explain much beyond that, though. What we're looking at is the cognitive deficits model, which, as I said earlier, suggests that paranormal believers are more prone to cognitive biases or sometimes some cognitive abilities. The final one, just to complete, is a motivational model that suggests that paranormal believers have a need for control, possibly stemming from childhood trauma or lack of control in childhood. Okay? So what we're looking at today, really, is this one here, the cognitive deficits model. Arguably, the cognitive deficits and the self-analytics are the two most robust models anyway. So that's where we are today. So, the cognitive deficits model, just to give you a brief overview of what research has been done since the sort of mid-70s, early 80s. Evidence that paranormal believers are less intelligent. Some early studies suggested that was true, but more recent studies suggest no. So there's mixed evidence there. Are they less educated? Again, mixed evidence. Some studies suggest there is, some say no. One study looked at whether or not paranormal believers were less scientifically educated, again, likewise, mixed evidence. Are they poor at critical thinking? Again, there's a trend here, isn't there? You see, okay, mixed evidence for that. I think this was Chris Rowe's paper, I think. He gave paranormal believers and non-believers a method section, or a fake paper to read, and he found that paranormal believers and non-believers made no differences in their critical thinking of that particular paper. So it's quite specific, okay? But the idea is that in terms of evaluating scientific papers, the two groups didn't have much differences. The strongest evidence suggests that paranormal believers are more prone to syllogistic reasoning biases, and also probabilistic reasoning biases, and also misperceiving randomness. Okay, so we have here the probabilistic and the randomness angle really is where we're looking at. Okay, paranormal believers tend to misunderstand probability and misperceive randomness to a greater extent than non-believers. But generally speaking, everybody's pretty poor at it, especially third-year psychology students. Okay? So that's where we're coming from now. We're looking at really G and H. So when we look at the evidence for these probabilistic reasoning biases, one of the earliest studies was Blackmore and Trosianko, and they found that paranormal believers made more errors when judging the outcome of coin tosses. So they were given a series of pretend coin tosses and was asked to predict what would come next, for example. Likewise, they made more sampling errors for numbers of people in hospitals that are going to be born male or female, that sort of thing. There's a number of little vignettes that were given out. But generally speaking, paranormal belief was more prone to making errors for these type of reasoning tasks. Brugger et al. Also found that when asked to predict a run of coin tosses or dice throws, again, paranormal believers were more likely to avoid repetitions. In other words, paranormal believers would tend to think that a run of dice throws would be 1-2 or 1-4-6-5, would not pick 1-1-1, because that doesn't look random, even though, objectively speaking, that would be a random series of dice throws. Tobachik and Wilkinson found that in terms of games of chance, paranormal believers preferred chance games, presumably because they felt they had a control over that. And Bresson found that paranormal believers tend to report more meaningful coincidences. And this is really what we're looking at, these remarkable coincidence experiences. They tend to be more meaningful for people who experience them. And paranormal believers are going to report more of those because, by definition, they're more meaningful for them. This is your paper, wasn't it? Yes, there was some evidence to say that paranormal believers are more prone to misperceiving the odds of lotteries. And generally speaking, the argument is that paranormal believers have a lower threshold of subjective chance. What that means is that they tend to dismiss the notion of chance or coincidence more easily, and they tend to look for meaningful patterns or meaningful relationships in what is essentially random noise to a quicker extent than do non-believers. So they're always, the idea is they're looking or they're biased towards finding meaningful connections. Now, early research in the 70s by Kalman and Tversky found that these sort of biases are most likely when two events co-occur. Okay, they're called conjunctions. And I'll give you an explanation of this in the next example, hopefully to make things a bit clearer. So, imagine Chelsea FC, who have got a squad worth £300 million, up until yesterday, it's about £15 million, are drawn against Charlton, who's got a squad worth about £14.50. Any Charlton fans? Yeah, too scared to admit it, aren't I?
I've been sighted.
Okay, so Chelsea are playing Charlton. Massive squad value differences, massive quality differences. So, they play each other in a cup. Now, I'm going to ask you, which is the most likely of these options? Chelsea score first and go on to win the game, or Chelsea score first and then ultimately draw the game, or Chelsea score first and lose the game? Who would like to vote for A? You're not counting. Is that three? Okay. B? C? D? Who doesn't really care? Thank you. Who put B? Okay, do you want to explain your reasoning? Do you want to?
Because Chelsea
thought of as like
a better team and that are worth more money, then you're
going to
assume that they are a better team in fact than Charlton, therefore you would expect them to score first, and
expect
them to win.
Okay. Anybody else
want to
explain their reasoning? It's a fair point.
Well, I kind of want to change my mind and go back to A.
You can't do that. It's a multiple choice, you can't, you've done that.
You've kind of been drawn into thinking, well, they're going to win, so that's the likely outcome.
Yeah.
So that's the most probable, the most likely thing.
Okay. You're falling victim to the conjunction phase, I'm afraid. Okay. Anybody that didn't say A are falling victim to the conjunction phase here. I'll explain. So here we have two options, okay? Chelsea score first, SF, in blue, and Chelsea win, regardless of who scores first. They're the two options we have. If you marry them up, when this works, okay, what we're looking at is the combined impact of Chelsea scoring first and winning, okay? Which is what B, option B was. This is what you picked,
yeah.
Okay? Now, hopefully you can see there that that middle section is always going to be smaller than either of the two other sections, by definition. You can never have it more likely. So Chelsea could score and then go on to lose, or Chelsea go score and go on to win. That's always been more likely. Sorry, Chelsea scoring first has always been more likely than any of the outcomes, by definition. Okay? So generally speaking, you can't see anything. Okay. The probability of two component events. Now in this example, the two component events would be Chelsea scoring first as one event, and Chelsea winning as another completely separate event. So the probability of two component events co-occurring, which is the middle bit, can never be greater than the probability of either of the two events occurring alone. It's simple statistics, okay? And this is what we're looking at. This is quite a buff.
But you have an option up there of Chelsea winning on their own.
Well, they have to score a goal, wouldn't they, to win?
Yeah, but they don't necessarily have to score first to win.
No, but I'm just doing comparison between the four groups. He's always one in every order. Yeah. I was looking at the comparison between Chelsea scoring first and the other options.
If you have Chelsea winning, I would just vote for that one. Thank you,
Rachel. She's a plant. She's supposed to be on my side, wouldn't be, would you? Right. Okay. It's a robust finding. It comes stemming back from the early 80s, and this has been applied in many areas of psychology, but less so in paranormal psychology. So you're okay with conjunction fallacy?
And with the wording of the question, there is a kind of assumption that they score first and they lose.
Was that?
Well, yeah, because that was different than scoring first and winning, so you assume that those two things are different.
You've lost me, I'm afraid.
Well,
What I've done, the B, C, and D, yeah, always imply the A. They've always all got A in them. That's the point.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
So you could have Chelsea score first and Drogba's head falls off. It doesn't matter, you know. Anyway, so that's the conjunction phase. That's where we are. So we're looking at the relationship between paranormal belief and this particular type of probabilistic reasoning bias. Okay, it is a particular type, but I think it applies quite nicely to these remarkable coincidences that many people think are examples of ESP. In terms of previous research, there's been one study up until what I was doing, 4 years ago now. They gave, I think it was psychology students, they gave psychology students a hypothetical football scenario, much like the one I just showed you, but they had fake names, team A or team B or whatever they called them. Okay, and they found that paranormal believers made as many CF, conjunction fallacy errors, as non-believers. In other words, paranormal believers were not falling victim to this particular type of bias. The problem with this particular study is that the vignette itself was nothing to do with the paranormal, so there's no really a priori reason to suspect maybe paranormal believers would be biased. It might be that the bias is just for paranormal events. They also used a particularly poor measure of paranormal belief by Tobolchik, which includes things such as the Loch Ness Monster exists, witches exist, God exists, and we all know, of course, witches do exist. So, you know, it was a very broad-based and psychometrically dodgy measure. And as I said a second ago, they used psychology students for their study, and you would assume that at least one or two psychology students would know something about statistics. I know it's an assumption. So we thought, well, we'll take this study, we'll tidy up the methods, and we'll bring in some other factors to look. So this is the first thing I'm talking about. Paranormal belief and the conjunction fallacy. We're looking at different event types, paranormal versus normal, and we're looking at question format, and I'll explain why we do that in a second. Okay. So, we're aiming to test whether paranormal believers are more prone to the conjunction fallacy than non-believers, and if so, is this particularly for paranormal events, or is it across the board for both normal and paranormal events? So the idea is that paranormal believers should make more conjunction errors than non-believers, that's the first hypothesis. Given a paranormal event in particular, second hypothesis, and given a probabilistic reasoning format. Now the reason we introduce format is because some evidence suggests that depending on the way you ask the questions, sort of maybe not quite what Rachel was pointing out, but it's the way you ask the questions in terms of what options people have. If you suggest to somebody that you have a frequency estimation task, in other words, how many people out of 100 do you think would be in A, B, or C? It's a different set of results than if you simply ask what the probability of the chance is, 1 to 100. So even though the actual options are the same, people are influenced by the way the format in comes forward. Okay, so we want to look at that. This is one of my colleagues, John Fiske, who threw this one in there. So we just want to look to see whether or not, because we're looking at probabilistic reasoning bias in paranormal believers, are they more prone to questions that are formatted as a probabilistic reasoning rather than a frequency estimation problem? Okay. So, method, I'll zoom through this bit. 200 people, slight bias towards females, 2% had degrees in maths, stats, or psychology. So we'll take those out. Average age is about 22, so quite young. And the design, two belief and non-belief groups, two event types, paranormal and non-paranormal events, and I'll explain that we did how we used those later on. And then the two conjunction formats, probabilistic reasoning and frequency estimation tasks. We used the mixed ANCOVA, and the ANCOVA bit was controlling for respondents' levels of math, stats and psychology, because the idea is that if they do have a more background in these areas, they should be less prone to these biases. So we wanted to make sure that people were on a level playing field. The dependent measure, the things we were measuring, was how many errors people made. Total number was 16, but we had 8 for each type. So 8 paranormal errors possible and 8 non-paranormal errors possible. Okay? Hopefully that's clear. We used a different measure of paranormal belief. The Australian sheep goat is generally considered to be a much more psychometrically sound measure. It focuses on 3 types of paranormal belief, mainly ESP items, a few psychokinesis, PK items, and I think about 3 life after death items. So it's predominantly ESP beliefs. Okay, but I threw them all in, and we had ended up with just over 100 believers and just under 100 non-believers. We did a median split, so we expect to get roughly even numbers. The scenarios, we had 8 paranormal scenarios and 8 non-paranormal scenarios. I'll give you an example in a minute. And we asked people, once they've read the scenario, there's only about sort of 3 or 4 lines to each scenario. And we said, okay, here are 3 options. So if we go back to the football example, what is the likelihood that Chelsea will score first? What is the likelihood that Chelsea would win? And what is the likelihood that Chelsea will score first and win? Okay, that's the sort of format we have. So what we're looking at is people's estimates of A, the first conjunction, so the first component, B, the second component, and then the combination or the conjunct of the two components. So that's the conjunction A plus B. And if people predict the A plus B, the last option, they made an error. If they said that was most likely, that's when they made the error. Okay, is that clear? 1 or 2 nods of those people speaking. Okay, I'm used to that. Okay. So we asked, half the sample were given probabilistic reasoning, how many in chances of 100 type formats, and the other half were given the frequency formats, how many people out of 100. So that's just a simple formatting manipulation. And we had various demographic items, including their levels of qualifications in math, stats, and psychology. So, typical student sample, opportunistic, off to the library campus, counterbalanced the order of scenarios. So all the scenarios were random ordered, and also within the little questionnaire pack, whether or not the panel belief questionnaire came first before the scenarios, and half the group got the other way around. So they had the scenarios before the panel belief items. So we made sure there was no order effects there. So here are the results. Sorry, this is an example first of all. Here's a typical example of a paranormal scenario. Billy has a long-lost friend who he's not seen in years. They were good friends in school, but drifted apart when they went to different colleges. Billy comes home from work one evening and sits down to eat his dinner. And then the 3 options you have to rate are, what's the likelihood or frequency of Billy thinking about his long-lost friend? What's the likelihood of Billy's long-lost friend unexpectedly telephoning? And what's the likelihood of the 2 events co-occurring? Who votes for A? Who votes for B? Who votes for C? You've not been listening, have you? C is a conjunction, okay? And going to think back to the football example, C is never going to be more likely than either A or B by sheer objective probability. Okay? So that's the paranormal scenario. This is a typical sort of telephone precognition type thing. The non-paranormal example included, Robert goes to a seafood restaurant for dinner with his friends. They've not eaten there before, don't have much time and are hungry, so they decide to try it. The restaurant is unclean, grubby, run down, generally gets few customers. It sells food at cheap prices. So, the 3 options are, the crab is off, Robert is taken ill the next day, and then both events co-occur. Okay? Who votes for A? No, you've heard it. You know. Right. If C is the answer, you're wrong. Okay? That's the conjunction. So they're the typical sort of scenarios. We had about 8 paranormal and 8 non-paranormal. There's the results. I won't spend too long on that. I won't bore people. But the icons there, belief effect is B, events type effect is E, the little crosses means it's an interaction effect, and the F is the format. Okay. So just to highlight them, there was a significant belief effect down here. Okay. Believers tended to score more errors than non-believers. Okay. I'm only focused on the panel belief effects here. Here we have a belief by event effect. So here you can see there, believers tend to make more errors, but bizarrely for the non-paranormal events, not the paranormal. So that's not what we expected. Okay? The non-believers also made more errors for the non-paranormal events, okay, compared to the paranormal. A near significant effect, the A means approaching significant, for the believers and non-believers scores across the 2 formats, you can see there that both the believers made a higher number of errors for both formats compared to non-believers. And that's that. Just focus on the belief there for a moment. Okay? So to summarise that, once we've taken out gender, because paranormal belief tends to be higher amongst females, and their level of qualifications in stats, maths and psychology, once we've controlled for those, we have a significant belief effect. Believers made more errors than non-believers, as we predicted. Event type, more errors are made for the paranormal versus the non-paranormal events across everybody. No main effect for a format, so across all people, format had no real impact. In terms of event type, believers made more errors for both types of events. That really supports that there. There's no real differences within believers across two event types. And in terms of the format, believers made more errors for both format types than non-believers. Again, that supports the early one. So format didn't really impact on believers' measures for believers themselves. Okay? So really, we found was that. That hopefully summarises the results a bit clearer. Okay? So, believers there tend to score higher relative to non-believers on those two bars. Hopefully that's clear. Okay, I'll just summarise that. Believers made more conjunction errors for both paranormal and non-paranormal events than in non-believers, and both groups made fewer errors for paranormal than for non-paranormal. So bizarrely, here, it was contrary to what we expected.
You've heard it.
A quick sneaky thief, didn't you? So I've said this before already, but basically believers are more susceptible to conjunction fallacy, and that supports the notion they're more prone to certain probabilistic reasoning biases, and therefore on a broader level, more cognitive deficits. Okay, that's our first hypothesis supported. Event type, believers made more errors for the alleged paranormal events, so that would suggest at first glance domain specificity. But when you look at the non-paranormal events as well, it suggests actually believers' biases are generic across the board. It doesn't matter what the event is, it's their bias applies all over the shop. So we had partial support for the second hypothesis. Format, little effect really, just supports the original belief effect, so nothing there at all. Some methodological issues with this particular study. First of all, although we had all students rather than just psychology students, they were still students. So we tried to factor out the background in maths, but you can't really generalise a student sample to the general population. For example, there tend to be about 22, so we want really a general population sample idea. One of the things we thought about afterwards was actually when you consider the stories we told, the vignettes we told for the paranormal events, many of them were essentially alleged precognition examples. So in the Billy example, Billy thinks of a friend and then the friend phones later. And there's a temporal gap, there's a little gap between the first event and the second event. And would that have any impact? Because in the non-paranormal conditions, there were fewer of those type of scenarios. There was one, the food one was an example, getting food poisoning was one. But most of them didn't have that temporal gap. And we wondered whether or not that might influence people's perceptions of these conjunctions. And then Fisk has come up with the original theory that the conjunction fallacy doesn't represent what is most likely, which is the sort of thing you were talking about Chelsea being most likely to win. That's the old view of conjunction biases. He was interested in whether or not it's the surprisingness of one event or the other event that actually determines how likely you are to make these errors. Okay? So it's not how likely it is, it's how surprising it is. It's the mere opposite. So we were interested in the second study to look at the potential surprise value of the actual two events in isolation. Okay? Potential surprise value has been found to be more powerful in determining how many errors people make for these things. So if believers are less surprised by the conjunction, the non-believers, that could be because of their paranormal worldview, because they don't find these things surprising because they expect them to happen. So it might be down to how surprising a paranormal believer finds these remarkable coincidences. They expect them, they believe in ESP. So this is the second study then. We look at paranormal belief again, obviously. This time, we're manipulating the temporal relatedness, and I'll give an example of what that means later on. The time gap between the first event and the second event, we're manipulating that. And we're also looking at potential surprise values of the first event and the second event in relation to the two events combined. This is where it gets a bit tricky now. Are you following me? Yeah? Could somebody explain it to me? Because I'm completely confused. Obviously not, no one's answering. Okay, right, so here we go. Potential surprise. Surprise theory suggests that more surprising, or in other words, unlikely events, constituents of events are these isolated one or the other, A or B. So the unlikely event alone will determine what the estimate of the conjunction is. That's the original surprise theory. So the idea here is that if you have one surprising event on its own, A, let's say, and one likely or unsurprising event, B, it's only the A, the first event, that has any impact on their conjunction, the estimate of the combined conjunction. The second one, the likely event, is almost redundant. It's just an anchor. It just doesn't really do much. Okay? So it's the importance of the unlikely event that seems to be key. That's the theory. Okay. Now, the idea is that because panel believers have this lower threshold of subjective chance, in other words, because they tend to dismiss chance and look for reasons or causal relationships amongst random noise, that they tend to assign lower surprise to what is essentially a surprising constituent. Okay? So, do panel believers have lower estimates of this unlikely event? Okay? So, if Billy's long-lost friend suddenly phones, a panel believer might see it less surprising because, as I said before, they believe in ESP or precognition. Okay? The alternative to that theory is that believers somehow see these events as being more related because of their worldview. So if they have a surprising event, such as Billy ringing up suddenly, they see that as being causally related to what they thought about Billy ringing, because they believe ESP is a causal connection. So it might be the relationship between A or B and how that relates to the A plus B. Am I confusing people?
Slightly.
Who said that? Who said that? Where? Right, okay. I'll try and do it again. There's two possibilities. You've got the A and the B as separate individual items. Yeah, Billy thinks of his friend, Billy's friend rings up. And what we're interested in is how likely they are perceived to be relative to the two events co-occurring, A and B. Okay? Now, the two possibilities are that panel believers are expecting these events to occur, so they don't think they're particularly surprising, so their estimates of A or B are lower, or they see different relationships between either A and B on one side and A plus B at the other. It's the connectedness, the relationship between those two that they have a different relationship with compared to panel non-believers. Shall I carry on and see how it goes? No one's walked out yet, so I'm going to do it. Okay? So in other words, in this example, think about Billy is more strongly related to Billy actually ringing up because people feel that they have... It could be, for example, telepathy. If Billy thinks about his long-lost friend, it could be because he's actually connecting mentally with his friend and is about to ring. So there was a relationship there. Billy only thought about his friend because his friend's actually picking the phone up. And that's the causal relationship. This is maybe what's going on. So, aimed, we're examining panel belief susceptibility conjunction fallacy again, but this time we're looking at the temporal relatedness, that is the gap between the first event and the second event, and how surprising believers find paranormal and non-paranormal events. So the first hypothesis is, again, that paranormal believers make more errors. Because we found no differences in the first study, we predicted no differences in the second study across the two event types, paranormal versus non-paranormal. We are predicting that there will be more errors for temporally disjointed events, however. And there's two possibilities for the fourth hypothesis. On the one hand, if it's the surprisingness of either event A or event B that's key, if we control for those in our analyses by using those covariates, we'll be able to remove any differences in any subsequent A plus B estimation. I'll repeat that. If we control for the probability estimation for A or B as individual isolated predictions or estimates, that should remove any differences in the conjunction estimates if it's down to the surprise value. Alternatively, if it's the relationship between the first event and the conjunct, then that should have no impact. Hopefully the examples will make things a bit clearer. So this time we had 156 people, aged slightly older this time, 32, a slightly higher number of degrees in maths, stats and psychology. Again, roughly the same percentage of females, just slight bias towards females. This time the design was two belief types, believers, non-believers, two event types, again, paranormal versus non-paranormal, and this time two relationships between the events and the co-occurrence, or the two events, sorry. I'll give an example to hopefully clarify that. But event A and B happened at the same point in time, approximately, you can't be dead on, but virtually co-occurring, or there was a big time gap between the two. So we want to look to see if that had an influence on perceptions of paranormality. Same sort of analysis, ANCOVA, we control again for the mass and stats qualifications, and again, as before, the number of conjunction errors, 0 to 8 for each type, made up our measure that we were looking to, our dependent measure. So again, same materials as last time. I'll give an example of the scenario to hopefully illustrate things, but exactly the same format really. And this time, a general population sample, small businesses basically means Costa or Nero's. People sitting in coffee shops with loads of time on their hands. Great way of sampling people. And again, you're counterbalanced. So, here is a scenario. They're virtually identical this time. You'll see the difference. In this example, Alan is a 49-year-old accountant who comes from a large but distant family. One day, his uncle, whom Alan has not spoken to in over 10 years, is suddenly taken ill with severe chest pains and shortness of breath. Alan's uncle is rushed to hospital and dies soon afterwards, age 87. A week later, Alan consults A. Now, in the paranormal scenario, a medium. In the normal, non-paranormal scenario, a lawyer. So everything is exactly the same except for one word. Yeah? So that's taking out any other idiosyncratic biases from the type of scenario we've got. And then the three options. Alan is told his uncle died of heart failure. Alan is told he inherits £1 million. And both. Who wants to predict A? B? Got the conjunction error. C is obviously the error. Okay, the conjunction error. It doesn't really matter whether A or B is considered to be more likely. It's the difference between A versus A, B on one hand and C on the other that's key. Okay? So this time we've got virtually identical scenarios except for one word, the paranormal source or the non-paranormal source. In this example, if I got it right, this is a co-occurring event, virtually co-occurring event, because he's told his uncle died of heart failure, and he's told he's going to get £1 million inheritance virtually at the same time. If it was a disjointed event, it might be someone who's gone to spiritual healing, had an injury, went to spiritual healing, and then got better over a six-week period. So we make the time gap very explicit. So here's that table again. You can see there, not many results, unfortunately. Okay, belief effect and a temporal gap by event type. So in terms of belief, down there, okay, high number of errors this time, interestingly, but paranormal believers made more errors there than non-believers. And in terms of the gaps, this is for everybody now, okay, we have slightly higher number of errors made for non-paranormal co-occurring events. So that might be something like, imagine in the first example I said about the fish restaurant, you go to the fish, you eat a mouthful of fish and suddenly you throw up. That might be a co-occurring event, okay? So to summarise that, belief, believers made more errors again, non-believers supports the first study. Event type, nothing there at all this time. Temporal relationship, nothing there at all either. Most of my research is like this. And in terms of the relationship between event type and temporal gap, most errors made for the co-occurring and non-paranormal scenarios, which is counter what we might expect. Okay? But when you look at breaking this down using what is called post hoc simple effects analysis, I won't go into the details of that, it basically wasn't supported. So it's a weak finding at best. Okay, so you can maybe dismiss that one. So that's what we really found, really. We just supported the earlier study to find that paranormal believers are more prone to these biases across the board, regardless of any event type. And hopefully that is a bit clearer there, okay? So believers in the blue generally score more errors across the four options, which is paranormal event, non-paranormal event, and disjunction, disjointed versus co-occurring events. So there's the four types there. So basically the fact that the blue line is higher is all you need to weigh about. Anything says that? Okay? No differences across event type or temporal relationship. Disappointing, but, you know, we stroll on. So the next thing was to look at the surprise value of people's initial estimates. Remember when I was asking how likely is it that in the inheritance example, that was it uncle died of heart attack. So how likely is it the uncle died of heart attack? How likely is it that the character gets an inheritance? How likely are the conjunctions going to be together? Can you see that? I mean, people nodded, this is the first. Don't worry about it. What we're looking at, really, I'm just going to highlight it, is that, right? What we have to worry about is, this is these more surprising events, whichever one that might be. It might vary across the scenarios. The point is, the p-values, there, those little asterisks, all suggest a strong relationship, okay? Now, these are the covariates. So when we control for the more surprising prediction of A or B, whichever one it is, once we take that out, there's a significant relationship with the number of errors made. When we look at belief type, there's some. And when we look at event type, there's relatively few. So there's more for belief type than there is for event type. I'll explain what that means in a minute. Let's get this. This is too much stats. Come on. Right, so this makes things a bit easier, okay? When you look at differences in the component probability estimates across the belief, believers tend to make higher estimates in 8 of the 16 scenarios. That's when we control for gender and mass only. That's the first set of analyses. When we also take out their estimates of the more surprising event, it has no impact at all. That's the key point. It has no difference. So that would suggest that their original estimates of surprise is irrelevant. If you look across the event type, same sort of pattern, there's a slight difference, but basically once you compare these effects across paranormal and non-paranormal events for the surprisingness of these events, there's a little drop, but it's virtually identical. So, controlling for the two component estimates, that is, how surprising do you find event A, and how surprising do you find event B, in other words, the surprise differentials, had no impact on how many errors people made for these type of events, how many conjunctions they thought was most likely. Is that clear? I'll tell that as a yes, I think. So, if it's not how surprising A or B is it the relationship between A or B on one hand and the conjunction? Is this something the panel believers see, a causal relationship? Is that what makes these bias is more likely in paranormal believers? Okay, so this time we're looking at the relationship, the component conjunction relationship, or the A or B on one hand, and the relationship between that and A plus B on the other, across believers and non-believers. Okay, now you can do this by looking at what is called the homogeneity of regression. I won't go into more details of that, just trust me on this one. It's a slope. Okay, do you see that? No, don't worry about it. It's basically, there's not much there. Look for the dots. There's not a lot there in terms of when you compare the relationship between belief and unlikely, the surprising events. There's not much there. And there's even less when you look at the event type and the unlikely surprise. Let's hit off that and summarize it. So, in terms of believers, when you just compare the relationship between the errors and the likely event, there's nothing at all. When you compare the relationship with the unlikely event, the more surprising of the A or the B, there is some relationship between that and the conjunction error. There's not much difference across paranormal and non-paranormal beliefs. So, in other words, the functional relationship between component and conjunctive probability estimates was, for the vast majority of scenarios, unaffected by differences in belief status. Okay, there was no differences, actually. That's not clear from there, but I'll come back to that. So let's just summarise that. In terms of paranormal belief, believers made more errors again. That supports the earlier study, and that's further support for the cognitive deficits model. In terms of event type, no differences across paranormal versus non-paranormal events. So that supports the idea that it's not domain specific, further support in the first study. The difference in terms of temporal gap between A and B events, no differences at all. There is some evidence to suggest that there is a relationship, there's good differences in how surprising paranormal believers found these. However, these persisted once you controlled for the effects. The errors people made persisted once you took out how surprising paranormal believers found the initial events. Okay, so that's supposed to be suggesting there's no errors. More surprising components cannot explain CF biases. It's meant to be read to suggest there's no differences. Okay. I'll just repeat that. More surprising components. So whether or not paranormal believers thought A or B was more surprising doesn't explain why that errors. In terms of the relationship, surprising proponent that had more influence in determining the relationship for both belief types, both paranormals and non-believers. So that was that suggests that it is potential surprise that's key in making these types of errors, generally speaking, but not doesn't explain why paranormal believers are more prone to them. There's something else going on. Okay? So it's a relationship you can't explain. Relationship can't explain paranormal believers' susceptibility to these biases. In terms of methodological issues, this particular study does overcome some of the earlier problems of using psychology students, of having vignettes that don't relate to paranormal. So we overcome some of these early problems, okay? And it does suggest that the tendency to make these errors, these cognitive deficits, applies across the board, regardless of whether the event is paranormal or non-paranormal. Okay? So what explanations are there? We tested the notion that it relates to how surprising paranormal and non-paranormal events are perceived to be. We tested the notion that it's the relationship between surprising events and the conjunction at the end. And we tested the possibility that it relates to the gap between event A and event B. And we found nothing. So, where are we? Well, where next, indeed. So, back to the drawing board. It could be the perceived independence of the likely and unlikely events. We might go back to look at how people perceive how the two events A and B are related. It could be, as Chris Rowe once suggested, that we have a generally sort of pro-paranormal stance in our paranormal vignettes. And if we included a paranormal vignette where the likely outcome or the paranormal outcome didn't occur, that might give us some different findings. So we might look at the scenario content. So we might have non-paranormal, pro-paranormal, anti-paranormal scenarios. That might be a way forward. Or there might be some other characteristics that we haven't looked at yet, we need to think about. So the third study sort of takes that last bit on board. And we're looking at the idea that the event scale, forget the word salience, look at the word scale, okay? Does the size of a paranormal event, alleged paranormal event, or how vivid it's described, impact on people's perceptions of paranormality? You'll be thankful to know this is a slightly easier, hopefully easier, study to get your head around. It's the plane crash study, so I did that. I was obviously bored one Saturday afternoon. There you go. Spent hours doing that. Should I do it again? Good enough. There you go. Hours. I have no life. Anyway, so, the plane crash study. So we're looking at remarkable coincidences. This time, we're asking people to judge how paranormal versus coincidental versus rational they find a particular event. Okay? These RCEs, these remarkable coincidence experiences, as I said earlier, are very similar to reported cases of ESP. Previous research suggests that there are four explanations of why people misperceive these remarkable coincidences. They could be a hidden cause. So, for example, if you think of a plane crash, or a car accident, for example, people might be subconsciously aware of increasing traffic flow. And they're not actually consciously aware of it, but that might be the reason they expected a plane crash. Sometimes people will have a coincidence which is actually not what they predicted. It's a near miss. So I might, for example, say, I've got this horrible feeling there's going to be a plane crash tomorrow. And it actually happens next week. But I say, well, that's close enough, I must have been accurate. Generally speaking, people are ignorant of the law of large numbers, or truly large numbers, and that is basically the idea that if there's enough events going on, some coincidence is going to occur somewhere in the world. So, who had a dream recently of a crash, a plane crash, for example? Anybody? Didn't you, Chris? You told me.
Oh, yes.
Yes, you did. Yeah. People will dream of things like plane crashes, and anywhere in the world, there'll be a plane crash somewhere. And it's by sheer numbers that some of these predictions will coincide with an event that happens, just by the sheer likelihood and the frequency of these numbers. And then generally speaking, people tend to underestimate the likelihood of these co-occurring, these conjunction events.
But wouldn't, by definition of what you were saying before, that be a conjunction fallacy?
Yeah.
So, but like, when they do estimate the likelihood of a co-occurring event, it's a conjunction fallacy, but then when they feel like it's a coincidence, then it's they're underestimating co-occurring? It feels like a coincidence.
Maybe I've made myself clear. the conjunction funny is very robust, not just paranormal believers. Okay, so when you ask people, is it A, B, or C, a lot of people, most people will go for C, okay, unless they've had a wonderful lecture like this. Okay, and generally speaking, that is one of the reasons why we think there's some sort of connection, we think it's meaningful, but actually it's just a complete co-occurrence, coincidence. Okay, and if that's not answered, you come back and hit me later, yeah? Yeah? Okay. So, the idea, the misattribution hypothesis, or the paranormal misattribution hypothesis, is that paranormal believers won't accept coincidence as a valid explanation for things. They will tend to look for other explanations. Okay, and often it relates to the paranormal. So this is the paranormal misattribution hypothesis. Now what I want to look at is whether or not any particular characteristics of these coincidence experiences can make something appear to be more paranormal than it otherwise would be. Very little, any research, very little research in this area. Oh, that shouldn't be there. Should it? Yes, it should. Let me think.
This is the same version I have. Is this the lady?
No, I don't know.
Okay. Let's go for this. I forgot to delete it, I think. Yes, this is the one I wanted. Okay, so. Now, these coincidence experiences are unusual, and that makes them more. It should be vivid, really, rather than salient. Okay? Hang on, let me go through this. I think that's the wrong one. That's the wrong one. Right, so. I should delete those ones. So coincidence experiences are typically more personally meaningful, they're typically more emotional, and they're typically more vivid and imaginable. So when you have one of these, I predicted a plane crash and it happens, it really sticks in your mind because of the vividness and emotive nature of these events. Now, in terms of social psychology, there's been not much research in the last 20 odd years, thanks to one particular review that found that this notion of vividness effect, in other words, does a vivid description have any impact on social judgments, suggests that it's very elusive, there's not much there. Okay? Taylor and Thompson's review suggested that in terms of immediate judgments, vividness has no impact. There is some evidence to say that after a short period of time, if you ask to remember what you described vividly, it does have an impact. So memory is made more biased, more flawed, if you have a vivid description. And the longer the delay between the presentation of material and the recall, the stronger the vividness bias. That was the review in 82. There's been some studies to suggest there is maybe some vividness effect going on anyway. If you compare, for example, a personal description, personal experiences, or case study reports, it's simply richer and more vivid. Compare those to base rate statistics, vividness and rich personal experiences do have an impact. People tend to be more biased by that type of information. If you have a testimony that's described in a vivid way, it has a bigger impact on people's judgments of a car crash. And the defendant and not defendant, the what's the word? What's the defendant?
Prosecution.
No, I'll come back to it. The person driving had the crash. She goes to prison for longer. That's it. So the way you describe his clothing, for example, will have an impact on how long he goes to prison for. Likewise, in a study that looked at perceived maternal fitness, just describing the woman in different, more colourful language had an impact on how fit as a mother she was perceived to be. So there's some evidence that this vividness impact does impact on social judgments. So we wanted to look to see whether or not people misattribute paranormal explanations to a more vividly described coincidence experience. And this is to do with the paranormal misattribution hypothesis. Okay? And in this particular example, we've manipulated vividness in two ways. We've used more image-provoking adjectives in one set of vignettes, stories. Okay, I'll explain that in a minute. And we've also manipulated the size of a particular event. It's a fictive plane crash. So manipulate the size of the plane crash to see if that type of vividness effect has any impact on perceived paranormality. So we're looking to see, it should be scale, not salience. We're looking to see whether scale and vividness have an impact on perceptions of a particular plane crash. And I've used a plane crash because this is the sort of thing people often report. I predicted an event and then it occurred later. And ESP type or precognitive type experiences tend to be of disasters or personal losses or something like that. So that's one of the more likely type of event. We're suggesting here that believers would judge an accurate plane crash prediction to be more paranormal and less coincidental than non-believers. Almost by definition, that's the paranormal misattribution hypothesis. But if they're given a bigger plane crash, it seems to be even more paranormal and even less of a coincidence. And if it's vividly described, again, it seems to be even more paranormal and even less of a coincidence. Right? So we look at the impact that a larger plane crash and a more vivid description of that plane crash will have on people's perceptions of what caused it. And we also look to see whether or not paranormal believers are more confident in their judgments. So this time we had 261 people, average age 33, so slightly older again. Slightly more women, but you know, that's comparable. Again, about 10%, 8% 12%, 8%, 1 in 12 had degrees in maths, stats or psychology. This time the design was two paranormal belief types, believer and non-believer, two event salience or scale, large or small plane crashes, and two types of description, vivid or pale descriptions. I'll give you an example in a minute. Again, we controlled for covariance this time, gender, and this time we had 28 attribution items. That is, what do you think caused this prediction to be accurate? I'll give you an example in a minute. We used the same measure of paranormal belief. The plane crash was basically this guy, Steve, had a strange sensation. We didn't say dreamt of it, because that would eradicate any possible rational explanations. So basically, Steve had a strange sensation, a strange fear that there'd be a plane crash, and he rings up the authorities to say, there's a big plane crash tomorrow, and it occurs. We manipulated scale by saying that the plane crash was either a jumbo jet and 400 people died horribly, or it was a single light aircraft where the pilot died and that was it, and there's only one person on board. And the vividness was manipulated by having very basic factual statements such as the plane crashed into the ground and exploded, versus very rich, vivid image-provoking adjectives like there's a fireball and a plume of smoke and the terrifying explosion could be heard from miles around. So we asked people to rate 28 items, things like Steve's accurate prediction was a fluke, it was caused by a psychic ability, it was down to his knowledge of planes, it was just rational inference, things like that. It was messages from God, I think was one of them, and about 28 of them. And then we also asked people to rate how confident they were for their judgments, generally speaking. Again, we looked at various demographics, but took out the qualifications in maths, stats and psychology as a potential factor. Again, residential areas and coffee shops, again. And again, as in the other studies, we counterbalanced the scenarios and the questionnaires. So here is a typical scenario. This is the large scale and vivid scenario. So we give a little bit of introduction to Steve, just to warm people up. Average, well read. Then one evening, Steve feared a plane crash was imminent, and so contacted the UK Aviation Authority to warn them of an impending tragedy. The next day, Steve turned on the TV news to find that a passenger, Boeing 727 from Bristol, which was due to arrive at Heathrow at 11 o'clock, just crashed. So there's the prediction and the subsequent event that occurred. According to official reports, a fire broke out on one of the plane's engines, causing its nosedive 1,000 feet in 27 seconds. Any pilots in? Apparently that's just, you know, that's ridiculous. Apparently it's really low, so it should be 10,000 feet, but there you go. Nobody commented on that. Before smashing into an empty runway, all 400 passengers and crew perished in the carnage and inferno of flames that ensued. Eyewitnesses reported a terrifying explosion, followed a few seconds later by a huge fireball which lit up the night sky. The thick black smoke that followed could be seen for over 10 miles. Now, this is the fact that this is obviously a large crash. And you can say there's reference to Boeing 727, jumbo jet, and how many people died, 400 passengers and crew. In terms of vividness, can you see that green? Not really clear. Okay, we have words like nosedive, smashing, carnage, inferno, terrifying explosion, huge fireball lit up, thick black smoke, seen over 10 miles away. In the pallid or the non-vivid example, all those adjectives were taken out, and it was just the plane crashed, basically. So that's the manipulation. We ran the 28 items were subjected to what's called factual analysis. Basically, it bunched them down into a smaller number of items or factors that we can then analyse. We found five of these factors. So the 28 items can be broken down into five factors. Don't worry about too much about what these things mean. Chris will know what they mean. He can explain later. This is the key one. Okay. After we ran the reliability test to make sure that these factors were actually good factors, they were consistent, internally consistent, and reliable, we found that intuition, with that low figure there, wasn't very good, and the bottom one, which we couldn't explain anyway, just it was nonsense. So we got rid of those two and ended up with those three factors. So people made judgments of how paranormal the plane crash prediction was, how rational it was, and how much of a coincidence the two events co-occurred were. Okay? And you can see here that the strongest factor, if you like, which explained roughly a third of all the variance in the items, was the paranormal awareness item. The rational thinking was explained about a fifth of the variance, and the coincidence explained about, what's that, whatever that is, about 16th. Okay? And overall, we explained just under 60% of the variance. So it wasn't brilliant, but it was okay. There's still a lot of other things that could explain the differences in scores, but that's enough to work with. So what we did, we analysed these three factors across the manipulations in scale and in vividness of descriptions. And this time we controlled for gender, because there are gender differences, males and females, and also because we found students tended to be more rational in their thinking, we wanted to make sure that any differences we found was not simply down to their status as a student versus a non-student. So we took that out as a covariate as well. Can you see that? No, never mind. Okay, here we have. What we have there is a significant belief effect. Now, let's get this right. So, non-believers and believers there, in terms of paranormal awareness, as you might expect, believers raised it to be more paranormal than non-believers. That's almost tautological. And conversely, in terms of coincidence ratings, paranormal believers said it was less likely to be a coincidence than non-believers. Again, that's the paranormal misattribution hypothesis. You'd expect that. Vividness effect, there was one there, okay, so when we compare the, let's get this right now, when we get the vivid event there, oh, that's only for confidence. So people were more confident when they were given the less vivid or the pallid scenario, bizarrely, contrary to what we expected, okay. So we didn't have all these wonderful adjectives like fireball and explosion, people made more confident judgment, or more confident in their attributions. This is an interesting one here, the belief times vividness effect. Now let's get this right. Okay. It looks like there we have believers given the vivid scenario, score 3.57, and non-believers 2.60, and then slightly higher there for believers in the pallid, and slightly lower for non-believers in the pallid. So that suggests there that believers given the pallid, the non-descriptive ones, thought it was more paranormal. And down here we have a three-way interaction which includes scale, but this is again for confidence. So if we work out the figures, the highest figures tend to be there. So again, it's the pallid descriptions that people have more confidence in. So bizarrely, contrary to what we expected, the more rich the description, the more vivid, the more use of these wonderful adjectives, made people think it was had less confidence in these judgments. It was quite contrary to what we expected. Well, I'll summarise that again, hopefully. Okay, believers made more paranormal and less coincidental attributions, as you'd expect from the paranormal misattribution hypothesis, than did non-believers. Nothing to do with event scale, so it doesn't matter whether it's a big plane, or a jumbo jet, or a small plane, didn't have any impact on how paranormal these events were perceived to be. And for attributions alone, the descriptions, the vividness, the richness of these descriptions, had nothing, no impact on perceived paranormality, but it did have an impact on confidence. All respondents were less confident, in their attributions, given the more rich, vivid descriptions, which is contrary to what we expected. In terms of vividness of belief, believers made more power attributions for vivid and pallid crashes than did non-believers. So that really supports the belief effect earlier. There's no differences amongst believers across the two vividness types. Oh, hang on. Believers made less paranormal for vivid. Okay, so scratch that last bit. Believers made less paranormal attributions given the vivid. That's contrary to what we expected. We expected a vividness effect such that it seemed more paranormal if it was described more richly. And believers were more confident for the large and pallid versus the large and vivid. So again, it's the difference between vivid and pallid that's key there. Both groups were more confident for the small pallid versus the small vivid. So again, there we have the vivid and pallidness differences. So, to discuss that, believers made accurate crash predictions. They thought accurate crash predictions were more effective with paranormal awareness and less effective with coincidence. You'd expect that. That's the attribution, misattribution hypothesis supported. Event scale, no main effect for scale on causal attributions or attributions of confidence. I don't know why there's a gap there. And vividness, no main vividness effect on causal attributions. So that supports the notion that vividness effects are elusive in social psychology. People more confident of attributions for vivid crashes. That seems to be wrong. I'll come back to that. There was partial support for our vividness hypotheses. In terms of interactions, nothing really between scale and panel belief. And in terms of vividness and panel belief, believers made more accurate predictions of both vivid and padded crashes, seeing them as more reflective of a paranormal phenomena. But they had more paranormal attributions for the padded scenario, contrary to what I suggested earlier. Okay? Now, the argument might be that perhaps these vivid descriptions were too unrealistic or unbelievable. So when you describe these plane crashes in really rich terms, I just didn't believe them. But we ran some pilot studies before we ran this test. And we asked people how vivid, how realistic, how believable, how large, etc., etc. they were. And there was no differences in terms of realism or believability. So I can't explain that. Maybe somebody can help me out later. So it's not because these rich, vivid descriptions are more unbelievable. So that really rejects that hypothesis. In terms of methodological issues, well, we only use a single vignette this time, a plane crash. And it might be that this is idiosyncratic. And the other types of remarkable coincidence, like these telephone examples I used earlier, might have different results. We only use, likewise, one type of alleged paranormal phenomena, which is precognition. So maybe we could look at other types of ESP, like telepathy. And probably the biggest criticism of this paper is that the attributions were really given to people as they were reading the scenario. So they read a scenario and immediately made judgments of it. We didn't look at their recall. And it suggests from the Taylor and Thompson paper that really vividness only impacts on recall, either immediate recall, a couple of minutes later, or over a couple of days. So we might do a follow-up study where we have differences in memory biases for this. So let's just summarise the three papers. Okay? From the first study, we found that believers are more prone to conjunction errors. They make more biases for the co-occurrence of two unrelated events, and therefore they're more prone to probabilistic reasoning errors. But this was not specific to paranormal events. This was not domain specific. In the second study, we found that believers were not more surprised by events A or B, and so it can't be the potential surprise value that explains the earlier conjunction fallacy errors. And also, it wasn't the relation between events A or B in relation to event A or plus B. It wasn't the relation between the component and conjunction events. So we can't explain why, at the moment, paranormal believers make these errors more. In this third study, we found support for paranormal misattribution hypothesis in that paranormal believers judged this event to be more paranormal and less of a coincidence, but they were not influenced by that should be scale. They were not influenced by scale or vividness in any main way. So where do we go next? Well, as I said a second ago, we can look at the impact these biases, scale and vividness, have on delayed recall. We can look at other possible moderators of misattributions. For example, egocentric biases. People tend to be more prone to making judgments of paranormality for coincidence that occurs for them than for other people. And I've got some data on that I need to write up and find 5 minutes. So it could be to do with how self-relevant these events are. We could extend the length of temporal delay. So we could look at an event that occurs now, and then the prediction for an event occurs a day later versus a week later versus a year later to see if that has any impact. Although from the study two, you would expect not. We could look, as I said before, at the outcome type. We can have different outcomes that support or reject the notion of paranormality. Or we can look at events that tend to offer bad news versus good news. Given that a lot of ESP claims are for sort of warning signals of traumas. For example, somebody's going to die or somebody's going to have been in an accident or something. That's what people tend to remember. So we can look at whether or not the outcome of an event has any impact. And that's it, really, actually. And there's the papers. If anybody wants to trail through this, and I've got no life. There's the first paper. For study A is published, study B is published, and I'm still ploughing through study C, hence the slight errors in my presentation. I hope I didn't bore you, I hope I didn't confuse you. I only lost two people, so it wasn't terrible. That's usually, you know, a lot more than that in mine. If anybody got any questions, feel free to. Okay.
I did have one question regarding the first experience with Chelsea and.
So if you start again, I missed the first one.
I have a question regarding the first experiment.
Right.
With the Chelsea who scores and win afterwards. When Chelsea scores.
Oh, yeah.
Win afterwards.
Yeah.
Actually, there were like four variants of responses.
Yeah.
And it was one, I'm not sure if it was the one Chelsea scores and lose.
Let me get it up. Let me get it up. I'm looking at about there. Oh, where is it? Ah, there we are. So, 4.5. Right, so, there you go.
Yeah,
that's the one. Okay.
What's the difference why Chelsea score first and lose can't be true as the Chelsea scores first? What is the logic behind it?
So, what, if I got it right, what you're asking me is why does B, or sorry, what do you say? Why does D differ to A? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
Okay.
Why D can be to occur at the same probability as A?
Well, we're asking what's more likely. Now, if you consider, let's say the game's 10 minutes old, Chelsea score a goal. What can then happen in the rest of the game? They can carry on to win, which is B. They can lose a goal, a draw, C. Or they can lose. They can let two goals in. Yeah? Okay? You with me? Okay? If we look at all the options, Chelsea scoring first. How do I put this?
It's the thing they all have in common.
That's not quite that. I don't know. Explain what you mean.
Well, in all your four options, Chelsea score first.
Yeah.
So it's the thing, I was just explaining to the lady up there,
that
it has all the. In order for any of the other three options to happen, the first has to happen.
Yeah.
In those scenarios, it's like when I said, why didn't you just put up there about winning? But that wasn't an option.
I just paraphrase what Rachel just said. What we have here is all of these, B, C, and D, is a subset of A, by definition. Yeah? Is that fair?
Yeah.
You can't have Chelsea scoring first and winning if Chelsea haven't scored first.
No.
You can't have Chelsea scoring first and drawing if Chelsea haven't scored first. And likewise, D. So this is the bigger.
Basically, A equals B plus C plus D.
Yeah.
So.
Unless the game's abandoned.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a subset.
Yeah. So A's got to be bigger than, or at least the same size.
I'll come to you for that controversy. So you first.
I was wondering if you could talk more about.
Talk like, more?
What do you mean by cognitive deficits? Because, like, the idea that. So you're saying believers are more susceptible to cognitive fallacies, and so. Or conjunctive fallacies, so then they're more prone to cognitive deficits. And that to me seems like a logical. A false syllogism. Because. It's just because it's A doesn't necessarily mean that it's B, or like to say, like I'm not coming from a psychology background, so I don't know if that's a specific term that means specific things. But
which term is that? The conjunction of the deficit?
Cognitive deficit. Cognitively deficient is a pretty big thing to say.
It's an umbrella term. It was devised, or probably what, when was Irwin first studied? 93 was his first review? It was just an umbrella term to lump things like intelligence, critical thinking, critical reasoning, and all these things in education was thrown in there as well, as just a general umbrella term. And within that, the most robust evidence is that paranormal believers are prone to probabilistic reasoning or randomness perceptions, misperceptions. So it's just an umbrella term. That's all it is.
And so it's putting logic as the primary function of cognition?
Not necessarily logic. You could argue that reasoning, yeah, but then we have things like intelligence, which wouldn't be logic, just logic, would it? Although there's mixed evidence. It's a sort of nice umbrella term, just for to differentiate between the others, I guess, if you look at these ones, it's not to do with demographics, it's not to do with different attitudes and towards the world, and it's not to do with psychodynamic need or need for serving. It's just, it's an umbrella. You can call it misattributions if you like, but that's a bit more specific. It's just an umbrella term, you know. Oh, Rachel.
Yeah.
Be general with me.
I found your research very interesting, looking at the differences and similarities and things in between believers and non-believers. But let me just get the term right. Where is it? What's the name of that main term? Beginning with C.
Conjunction.
Conjunction, yeah. It seems to me that to sum up, we're trying to measure why believers in the paranormal make more errors in the conjunctive theory. But I think you're kind of not really going to get anywhere, because by very definition, they believe in the weird and wonderful, so they're going to believe more in the weird and wonderful. And you can't define belief. You can't. You can't. I don't think you can measure sort of things that I think are indefinable.
Okay, there's about four or five points there. I laugh because some parapsychologists hate the phrase belief, because they say there is enough evidence out there that ESP is genuine to eradicate the whole notion of belief. You're believing something exists, so don't use the word belief. Okay, I don't tend to go with that view. So, okay, that's the first point. So that's why I laugh. We use, if I get my little thingy up, we use, where's it gone? Here we go. Bear with me. It'll be a long one. Keep going. Next one. Right, not next one. Here we go. Right. There's numerous types of scale. This is what psychologists often use. Okay. This thing called the Australian Sheep Goat Scale has items that you ask people to rate 1 to 7. And what we do is we calculate the mean score, the average score, across people's 18 items, and then we decide whether or not somebody's a believer or non-believer, depending on whether they score above or below the average. It's not brilliant, you know, and we acknowledge that paranormal belief is a really complicated thing to look at. I use this particular scale because it focuses on belief in ESP. Okay.
But if, sorry to interrupt, but just to further before I forget, if you say to somebody, I know it's kind of the same thing, but it's not exactly the same, you know, do you believe in God? And they say yes.
Right.
You say, why do you believe in God? Sometimes they may have what they think is evidential stuff to back it up.
Sure.
Like, you know, I had this experience and
yeah.
The Holy Spirit came to me or whatever. But often they can't define exactly why they believe in God.
Right.
They just have a strong belief. And how can you define what belief
is? We're not defining, but we're testing one of the theories is that paranormal believers are more prone to these different types of errors. So this is why we had all these little vignettes and these little stories. So when we found a big difference, now admittedly, we have what's called a median split. So we have believers, you might consider them to be higher believers, and non-believers, you might consider them to be low believers. So I use the term believers, non-believers, just as an easier phrase. Because we found differences in the way the high and the low believers operate in terms of these biases, we can suggest that that is at least one factor. Okay, so probabilistic reasoning biases explains at least part of the reason why people believe in ESP. Not all of it. It may well, the biggest single predictor is having experience. But then I'm looking at the notion that perhaps people's experiences are reflective of these coincidences that they just misinterpret. So paranormal belief is a really complicated area anyway, and we can't explain everything, admittedly. But this is good evidence. There's these two studies now to say these conjunction biases are more prevalent in paranormal believers. So there's something going on there.
I could have told you that days ago.
All this research I've done. Waste
of time.
Just found
me out.
Yeah.
Well,
any questions direct to Rachel?
Right?
Yeah, just ask Rachel.
What you said has basically been is correlation and causation and the ability to distinguish between the two.
Okay.
I'm wondering, you mentioned right at the end the possibility of an egocentric bias. An egocentric bias.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that could move us into a whole different area.
Mm.
And the conjunction fallacy of everybody who smoked has stood at a bus stop waiting for a bus. And cigarette magic, you light a cigarette, and the bus will come.
Yeah.
Every single smoker will know that.
Right, okay.
Done it.
Okay.
Or
I'll take your word for that, I've done the
time. Okay. Or you're wearing a pair of red socks, when your team wins or whatever. So next time you're going to see your team play, no, we're getting into areas of superstitions rather than what you're looking at. But I think there's a lot of overlap between the two. And if you get more into questioning people about their own actual activities, not just their beliefs on hypothetical scenarios, but what they themselves do or have done, you might use this as a whole different field.
I don't get into the superstition stuff, although there's a massive overlap, and there are scales to look at superstition per se. In fact, one of the early other scales that I mentioned, the one, the Tobacek one, has things like black cat being bad luck, that sort of thing. So, yeah, there is definitely an overlap. I've got another point you can make. What was the other point? Causation.
If you move your study into make it more personal rather than hypothetical, you may get a whole different variety of results.
As far as I'm aware, the only paper that's looked at egocentric biases is by Ruben Thorpe in 89. It wasn't about paranormal. If I remember rightly, it was about being picked up by a hitchhiker. But I have got data that, when I get time, it was a train crash where it was either your train crashed, your sisters, so there's a relationship there, or strangers. You're in a cafe and you're chatting, well, you find it later. So when I analyse that, I'll be interested to see if there's any egocentric bias among paranormal believers. I would predict at the moment that paranormal believers would be more prone to this egocentric bias than non-believers. But after my second study, who knows? So, okay, I think I've worn everybody out.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Paul.